Do you think the Biden administration is doing enough? We're having a little trouble hearing you. Your sound is dropping out. We're talking to Manuel Oliver, who is co-founder of the gun reform group Change the Ref. His son, Joaquim, was one of 17 people killed in the 2018 mass shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. If you want to see the full images of this event that he organized in Las Vegas to demonstrate the loss, the pain, the horror of gun violence, you can go to democracynow.org. Manny, we have 15 seconds for your final comment on is enough being done?
We need to—it's the addition of different things. It's not only what President Biden is trying to do. It's not only what some leaders are trying to do. It's what we are trying to do, what the youth is trying to do. All those things together are bringing these conversations. We are having a conversation with no need of a mass shooting for you to call me. And that's advancing in the fight against gun violence.
We thank you so much, and our best to you and Patricia. Manuel Oliver, thank you. This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up, stay safe. Special thanks to our whole team here at Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival from Saturday, June 26th to Sunday, June 27th from 3 to 7 p.m. streaming online. Good in the Hood is a family-friendly, multicultural music, arts, and food festival that connects people with resources and experiences to strengthen unity in the community. Again, that's Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival on Saturday, June 26th and Sunday, June 27th from 3 to 7 p.m. streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, ex-cop Derek Chauvin is sentenced to 22 and a half years in jail for the murder of George Floyd. Oregon will lift coronavirus restrictions by June 30th, and the eviction moratorium is extended one more month by the federal government. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 25th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin will serve at least 22 and a half years in prison. Chauvin was convicted of murder for kneeling on George Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes in May 2020. His sentencing hearing started today with the judge rejecting a motion for a new hearing from Chauvin. Floyd's family made victim impact statements explaining how much they lost with George's murder. George's brother, Terrence Floyd, said this in the sentence hearing today.
I wanted to know from the man himself why. What were you thinking? What was going through your head when you had your knee on my brother's neck? Why, when you knew that he posed no threat anymore, he was handcuffed, why you didn't at least get up? Why you stayed there?
Under Minnesota law, the maximum murder sentence for someone with no prior criminal record like Chauvin is 30 years. The judge gave Chauvin 22 and a half years, and Chauvin could face more time since he's also facing federal prosecution for violating Floyd's civil rights. Chauvin is also expected to appeal his case. The three other officers at the scene of Floyd's murder are set to be tried in August for their involvement. Governor Kate Brown will reopen Oregon on June 30th, regardless of the 70% vaccination goal. Currently, the vaccination rate in Oregon is at 68.9%. 35,000 Oregonians must get their first shot to reach that 70% goal. Here's part of Governor Brown's address from a press conference this morning.
I'm so proud of our collective efforts to vaccinate more than 2.3 million Oregonians. It's because of these successes that we can move Oregon forward and into the next chapter of the pandemic. I know we're all certainly ready. To give Oregonians certainty as we prepare to transition into this next phase, when Oregon reaches 70% of adults vaccinated, or by Wednesday, June 30th, whichever comes first, we will lift the safety protocols we have relied on and reopen our economy. As I have detailed before, that means no more statewide mask mandates in most settings, no required capacity limits, and no required physical distancing. It means effectively, Oregon is 100% open for business. Today, I will be signing an executive order that will lift Oregon's risk level framework and all remaining COVID-19 health and safety restrictions that have been issued under Oregon's emergency statutes, effective when we hit 70% or June 30th, whichever comes first.
That was Governor Kate Brown announcing the coming end of Oregon's coronavirus restrictions. Excessive heat warnings will be in effect this weekend in the Pacific Northwest. Experts anticipate heat records being broken. On Sunday, temperatures are expected to reach 113 in Portland, with even higher temperatures in eastern Oregon. Multnomah County is opening cooling shelters for the duration of the heat wave from Friday afternoon through Monday. The Oregon Convention Center, the Arbor Lodge Shelter, and the Sunrise Center will be open 24 hours for folks who need to get out of the heat. Area libraries and TriMet are also offering services, and if someone needs a ride to get out of the heat, they can board without a fare. Residents can call 211 for more information on cooling shelters and also for a free ride to get out of the heat. No one will be turned away. Many homes in the area are not equipped with air conditioning, so cooling down will rely more heavily on water resources and fans. Some have offered advice, like taking a cool shower, wearing wet clothes, spritzing your bed sheets with water before going to sleep, and even leaving your bathtub filled, not only for needed water relief, but also to help circulate more water in the air. Experts say it's important to limit exertion in the sun and take care to hydrate in this extreme heat. It's also a good time to recognize the signs of heat exhaustion and heat stroke. If someone has heat exhaustion, they may show symptoms like faintness or dizziness, excessive sweating, a rapid weak pulse, nausea and vomiting, cool, clammy skin, and muscle cramps. To help someone with heat exhaustion, they need to move to a cool place and drink water if they're conscious. If someone has heat stroke, they may have a throbbing headache, confusion, loss of consciousness, a rapid, strong pulse, nausea, vomiting, and body temperatures above 103 degrees, with their skin being red and hot. To help someone with heat stroke, call 911 right away and keep them cool until help arrives. Many Oregonians are facing down the expiration of the state eviction moratorium at the end of June with dread. Just today, the federal government has extended its moratorium until July 31st. To learn more about how this change impacts Oregonians, we go to KBOO's Josh Salem.
The U.S. government just extended the national eviction moratorium to July 31st. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says this will be the final extension of the moratorium. It is unclear whether Oregon will extend its moratorium to align with the federal government. The Oregon State Legislature recently failed to agree to extend protection past June 30th. It did pass a bill that says tenants could not be evicted for 60 days if they can prove they applied for rent assistance. Multnomah County spokesperson Julie Sullivan Springetti says the federal extension becomes law when the state moratorium expires. She adds renters will be protected so long as they meet its criteria and submit a declaration form. That form affirms they cannot pay rent due to financial hardships caused by COVID-19. Oregon tenants will have until February of 2022 to repay rent payments they missed. A U.S. Census poll of Oregonian renters showed almost 20% of tenants had no or only slight confidence they could afford rent in the upcoming month. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Vice President Kamala Harris is visiting the U.S.-Mexico border this weekend. With more on that story and others, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
People are dying, children are being exploited, and they're being abandoned in the desert.
Amid criticism from Senator Rick Scott and other Republicans over the Biden administration's approach to the surge of migrants at the southern border, Vice President Kamala Harris will see the situation firsthand in El Paso today. Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas welcomes Harris's visit, but notes El Paso isn't the epicenter of the crisis.
You go to the Donna facility, you go to Roma, Texas, you go to Rio Grande City, you go to the McAllen area so you can get an idea of what's happening.
Harris recently visited Central America to promote diplomatic solutions. After hailing a bipartisan $1.2 trillion infrastructure agreement, President Joe Biden said he still wants other spending priorities to be addressed through reconciliation.
But if only one comes to me, if this is the only thing that comes to me, I'm not signing it. It's in tandem.
Paid leave for federal employees got a House committee hearing this week. President of the American Federation of Government Employees, Everett Kelly, promoted 12 weeks of paid family leave to care for a family member, or in the case of a family member's military deployment.
No federal employee should ever have to choose between caring for a loved one and keeping his or her job.
Republicans argue federal workers already have enough paid time off. The House is also debating ending co-pays for veterans who receive contraception from the Veterans Administration. Democrat Lauren Underwood of Illinois argued under the Affordable Care Act, civilian women don't have a copay.
It is unacceptable that women who have served our country bear financial burdens that most other Americans don't have to worry about. This fix is long overdue.
And several congresswomen want equal pay for U.S. national team athletes. A Senate bill would withhold federal funding of the 2026 World Cup unless pay is equalized between the men's and women's national teams. Now to events surrounding the January 6th insurrection. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is creating a select committee to investigate the attack on the Capitol.
January 6th was one of the darkest days in our nation's history. It is imperative that we establish the truth of that day and ensure that an attack of that kind cannot happen and that we root out the causes of it all.
Some Republicans argue the committee could turn into an overly political process, but politics are still in play as former President Donald Trump holds a campaign-style rally in Ohio this weekend and another July 3rd in Sarasota, Florida. A Department of Homeland Security official says the agency is concerned a conspiracy theory, which claims Trump will be reinstated as president in August, could trigger a violent response from extremists who believe the, quote, big lie, unquote, the election was stolen from Trump. The state of New York made its position on the so-called big lie clear this week, barring Trump's former personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, from practicing law in the state over his false and misleading statements about the 2020 election. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race. Then at 7, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Tonight's weather will dip to a low of 72 degrees. The extreme heat warning for Multnomah County and much of the Pacific Northwest starts this afternoon. Tomorrow's weather will be bright and sunny with a high of 107. Today in history, in 1978, the Rainbow Pride flag was flown for the first time at the San Francisco Gay Freedom Day Parade. The quote of the day is from Gilbert Baker, the American artist and activist who designed the original Pride flag. Baker said, quote, "A true flag is not something that you can really design. A true flag is torn from the soul of the people. A flag is something that everyone owns, and that's why they work. The rainbow flag is like other flags in that sense. It belongs to the people. A Saskatchewan First Nation finds hundreds of unmarked graves at a former residential school. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Another unmarked gravesite has been discovered in Canada on the grounds of a former Indian residential school in Saskatchewan. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the discovery comes after the remains of 215 bodies were recently found at a school in British Columbia.
The Cowessess First Nation in Saskatchewan is about 100 miles east of Regina. Its chief, Cadmus Delorme, describes what they found.
We started our radar penetrating research on June the 2nd of 2021. As of yesterday, we have hit 751 unmarked graves. This is not a mass grave site. These are unmarked graves.
Delorme says the representatives of the Catholic Church removed the headstones, so today they are unmarked graves. It's not clear how many of the bodies buried on the site of the former Maryvale Indian Residential School were Native children. Delorme says there are stories that there were adults buried there as well.
What we are going to be doing now is we are going to be putting names to these unmarked graves. We want to honor our loved ones that lay there today. We want to make sure that we keep that place and preserve it so many could come here and heal.
Delorme says he believes the Catholic Church, which ran the school from 1898 to 1981, will hand over records from the school. He says for now his band has just one book of records from a knowledge keeper. And he says while he expects cooperation from the Catholic Church, he also wants an apology from the Pope. The chief of the Federation of Sovereign Indian Nations, Bobby Cameron, says searches of residential school grounds across the country will continue, as well as sanatoriums of Indian hospitals and any sites where people were taken and abused, tortured, neglected, and murdered. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Descendants of the Wounded Knee Massacre, tribal leaders, members of the National Buffalo Soldiers Association, and some members of Congress took part in a ceremony Friday in Washington, D.C. Descendants of Buffalo Soldiers, African American Cavalry, presented a proclamation showing their support for the Remove the Stain Act, legislation to revoke medals of honor awarded to soldiers for their participation in the 1890 massacre of Lakota people on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Speakers touched on reconciliation and acknowledging past wrongs. Manny Ironhawk is a descendant of the Wounded Knee Massacre.
We have to have healing. We need healing. For 130 years, we carried this from generation to generation. My mother read the story, tells the story, and she cries. And so I said, someday it needs to stop. And with the help of all of our allies and our brothers here, we have hope. Hope for our children and grandchildren to continue and remember what happened at Wounded Knee.
Representative Kai Kahele says he was honored to reintroduce the Remove the Stain Act in the House.
As a proud veteran, a 20-year veteran, and a member of the House Armed Services Committee, the Medal of Honor is the most prestigious and the highest award and recognition that the United States military bestows on those that have served. And make no mistake, there was nothing, absolutely nothing honorable about the actions of those soldiers.
Legislation was also reintroduced in the Senate. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Minnesota is poised to prohibit driver's licenses from being suspended when a person fails to pay a traffic ticket or to appear in court for the violation. Backers say the change will prevent lower-income people from being trapped in a cycle that limits their ability to work. KBOO's Margot Reed has more.
If a Minnesotan fails to pay a traffic fine or appear in court for a low-level violation, they could lose their driver's license. But a law change appears likely, bringing relief to those who say the rule unfairly targets low-income people. As Minnesota lawmakers try to wrap up work on a new state budget, they're poised to include a provision to do away with the driver's license suspension for certain situations. Anna Odegaard of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition says national research links these suspensions with job loss, especially for people struggling to get by.
So what we see is that this license suspension creates a kind of cycle of debt and interaction with the criminal justice system.
The nonpartisan Legislative Coordinating Commission says suspension rates are higher in BIPOC and tribal communities. For those concerned about public safety, bill supporters say the rule remains in effect for serious violations, and unpaid tickets will still be subject to collections. Both the House and the Senate have approved transportation spending bills that include the plan. In northwestern Minnesota, Katherine Johnson leads the Inter-County Community Council, which helps fight poverty in a handful of counties. She says in rural areas, a license suspension can be especially problematic.
Most folks don't often work in the same community that they live, and so having a suspended driver's license just enables them to not get to their job.
Odegaard adds that stopping suspensions prevents people from making the difficult choice of driving when they shouldn't or taking a risk to maintain their income.
Because that enables people to continue driving legally, keep their jobs, take care of their families, while they work on paying off their debt to the court.
The proposal saw bipartisan support in the legislature and also has the backing of a number of legal groups, including the Minnesota County Attorneys Association and the Minnesota State Bar Association. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Margot Reed.
Earlier this week, Portland police announced that they wouldn't be stopping drivers for minor violations like broken taillights or expired tags anymore. Mayor Ted Wheeler cited the racial disparities in who is stopped, and Black Portlanders are way overrepresented. But that may not explain the full context of the decision. I spoke with Don Merrill of the nonprofit CNBC. Merrill's nonprofit offers to fix broken bulbs free of charge in an effort to keep people of color from being frivolously stopped by police and potentially ending up in a dangerous situation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, since Portland police announced this week that they'll stop pulling drivers over for minor violations, with some exceptions, but those violations are the kind of thing that your effort CNBC seeks to address. So what's your reaction been to that?
I am encouraged that the Portland police and the mayor have come to an agreement about reducing the amount of traffic-related stops because of burnout equipment. The Oregon statute calls it equipment, but it's burnout lights, turn signals, headlights, license plate lights, brake lights, things like that. But, I mean, I think the context is important. The Portland Police Bureau has lost hundreds of officers, and it's very difficult for them to even keep up with major crimes. I mean, there have been shootings, two, three shootings a night, every night for months. And it just makes sense to me that one of the reasons why they've decided to reduce the number of police stops for vehicles with burnout lights, because they consider that a relatively minor infraction compared to what they have to deal with. So I'm not really sure how much of it actually has to do with social justice. I think more of it has to do with just the realities that the police department is facing, which, you know, kind of makes me question the whole motivation of saying it's about, being more social justice when, you know, you look at what the police department and the city is dealing with, and, you know, that may not exactly be true.
Right. That was going to be my next question. Do you think that it's a meaningful step?
I think that it will make a difference in that drivers with burnout lights currently won't have to worry about being stopped by the police because they have a burnout light. My nonprofit seeks to deal with the issue of burnout lights, not only from a social justice perspective, but from a public safety perspective. So even if people of color aren't being pulled over by the police because they have burnout lights, there's still the safety issue, you know, and hopefully people are responsible and they realize that they have a burnout light. They need to get it fixed because, you know, if you're driving down a two-lane road at night and you have one light coming at you, you don't know if it's a car or a motorcycle, you know, I mean, that's dangerous. But I think that people don't have to worry about being stopped for frivolous reasons while the police in the city have made this agreement, this temporary fix. Because as listeners probably know, last Thursday, the Oregon legislature defeated House Bill 2002, which was supposed to enshrine in Oregon law the fact that police could not pull over people for minor infractions like burnout lights. So that failed in the legislature. So, you know, apparently, you know, the state house, you know, there are factions in the state house that don't want to see police power hindered to that extent because apparently they feel there's value in it, in being able to stop people for burnout lights. And I talk about why that is, you know, part of the broken windows theory. I talk about that on the CNBC website. It's a tool, a profiling tool that police use for cars as well as people. But in the interim, I think it's a good step because no one has to worry about being pulled over for a frivolous reason like getting their like a bulb burnout. And that also means then that there will be fewer harmful interactions between people and the police. I'm interested to see what happens if police staffing levels return to full strength, if this is a policy that the Portland Police Bureau and the city will continue to follow despite what the legislature does.
And so, you know, with that in mind, right, like the Portland Police Bureau have their jurisdiction, and within that jurisdiction, they've committed that these minor violations won't be cause for getting pulled over. But, you know, outside of that, as you mentioned, the state house and, you know, statewide, countywide legislation doesn't necessarily follow that. So with that in mind, is your effort with CNBC going to continue?
Absolutely. Because, like I said, it's either social justice or it's public safety. And, you know, at the very least, people can get their brake lights and turn signals and possibly headlights replaced for free. And it's not only public safety, but it's public education. Because at some of these events, I hope to be able to partner with, you know, social service organizations or social justice organizations or human rights organizations. So when people come to get their bulbs replaced, you know, they can learn about other programs going on in the city. You know, they can get more education about why this program exists and, you know, some of the other programs that exist in partnership with it, you know, to help improve life for everybody in the Portland area.
I also wanted to ask about the stops data, because that was a big part of your effort. And my assumption is that, you know, this saying that they're going to reduce stops will probably mess with that data a little bit. Are there other ways that the success might be of CNBC or of, you know, any of this might be reflected in that data?
If they're going to be reducing the number of stops, then the data is definitely going to be affected. But I think it's also important to remember this is not the normal situation. You know, this is not the normal situation in Portland, and it's not the normal situation around the country. The normal situation is, you know, and our legislature just proved it, the normal situation is police have the right to stop people with burnout bulbs. And more often than not, that's profiling. Because, you know, in some parts of the city and in some neighborhoods, people drive around with burnout bulbs and are never stopped by the police. In other neighborhoods, people drive around with burnout bulbs and are always stopped by the police. So the normal situation is people are pulled over for burnout bulbs in certain neighborhoods. I think that the data is going to be skewed because right now, because of staffing levels and other things going on, the Portland police can't do that. So yeah, the numbers will look like there's been an improvement, you know, and that might be something that, you know, maybe some people would point to and say, see, it's working. But I think it's important to remember that these are extraordinary circumstances right now. And I think that when circumstances return to normal, those stop data numbers will return to normal, which unfortunately is, you know, bad for people of color.
Right. If the Portland Police Bureau get over 100 officers back on staff, that might be something they start going after again.
And I think also it's important to consider that if it does return to normal, to what it was, you know, before COVID, it kind of says something about the commitment of of the city, you know, and the police to actually do this thing that they say they're doing for a social justice reason. You know, what Chuck Lavelle and Ted Wheeler have agreed to is strictly circumstance-based. And I think that when things return to normal, so will the stops data. And unfortunately, so will the possibility of people being hurt or killed because of bad interactions with the police.
That was Don Merrill with CNBC, a nonprofit in Portland that's dedicated to helping people of color fix broken lights on their cars in order to lessen the amount of interactions with police. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 25th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Margot Reed and Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez and Mary Sherman. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines.